Hello, everyone. I'm Edian Porter de Leon at Porter de Leon on Twitter, and welcome to episode 124 of In Tech We Trust. On this show, we look at the efficacy of the technology platforms and tools that we use to connect and interact with each other.
We tend to miss some of the basics of how communication works between humans, and we make the mistake of putting the technology first, when in reality, it's the humans first.
And we explore the unique and evolving ways in which humans are communicating with machines.
I'm chatting with my router or whatever, checking on, you know, status or changing some sort of configuration. And this really could be useful. For example, chatting, you're with the entire team and your equipment, let's say, is in there.
Then we find out where the mismatch is between how we want to engage versus how companies engage with us over multiple channels.
The world has shifted from a broadcast mode into a networked mode, but not all companies have made that shift.
Finally, we take a look at the collaboration tools and productivity technology that we use inside the companies we work for.
You know, I think the benefits completely outweigh the challenges or the risks. And I think the important thing is an awareness that there is risks and that there can be risks and that you want to address them sooner rather than later.
Let's first take a look at this from a different angle. What does it mean to be present? To be here, right now, in the moment? Would you know what that feels like? Right now, as you're listening to this, in your car, on your commute, during your workout, or multitasking in your always-on, always-connected world, are you present? Are you focused on one thing at this very moment? Or does something else have your attention as well? What would someone talking to you say? Would they say that you seem focused, alert, present? Or would they say that it seems like your mind is elsewhere? When we talk to one another, we want to know that the other person is listening, is engaged, and is, well, present. But it's difficult at times. Actually, it's difficult almost all the time as we try to catch up on that inbox full of emails we need to respond to, that list of voicemail that hasn't been listened to yet, that really cute new cat meme that we want to share on Twitter, and that list goes on and on. But we know we have to give people the attention they deserve to build that trust and to foster those relationships. So we embrace communication tools that help us to provide the people we work with and the people we care about with those clear answers and the well-thought-out and articulated responses they deserve. During the moment, we can set aside to focus on that one thing. This moves us away from the synchronous or real-time communication mode to an asynchronous or time-distributed communication mode in which conversations are no longer happening right now at the same time, face-to-face, or over the phone. They are spread out over a period of time, threaded in email chains, Facebook or Twitter feeds, and Slack channels. And this has helped us in many ways. In fact, it's been transformative. But has it hurt us in other ways? And that's the theme of our show, communication. Do you communicate differently with your friends, your coworkers, your spouse, or your kids now that you can text instead of call? Would you have said more or expressed yourself differently to someone if you didn't have the option to simply press a like button at that picture they posted or that story they told? How have these tools changed the way that you communicate to the people in your real and virtual worlds? Well, here's what we found out.
In Tech We Trust. We're not sure about.
I had the opportunity to sit down with Jay Metz at Dr. Jay Metz on Twitter, R&D engineer for advanced storage for UCS, about communication principles in technology. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I was really intrigued by the idea of different communication principles within the technology industry. What's your take on some of the communication principles that you're seeing shaping the way that we use technology or the way that people in technology communicate with each other?
Well, the funny thing is that we have this myth in our industry that we do something special, that somehow the technology that we use is going to change us and change our communication habits just because of the fact that it's new. And we tend to miss some of the basics of how communication works between humans, and we make the mistake of putting the technology first, when in reality it's the humans first. And so a lot of our technological communication, or as you know, the academics called it, mediated communication, those things don't actually change just because of the fact that you have a different type of device to speak through. But we tend to miss those human elements in preference for the technology, which is cooler and flashier.
And I subscribe to this theory as well, because I think a lot of people miss that fact that it is. These are humans that are interacting with each other. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any of these tools. These tools are here to enable innate behaviors or desires that we have to communicate or connect with people in specific types of ways, to share ideas, to build community. Where do you think this shapes the dialogue for how technology moves forward, how new products get created, how new markets get created for communication platforms? How do you feel like that gets shaped by this idea that the technology comes first and then the human interaction comes later?
Well, the problem becomes that we're kind of like the fish who don't know that we're swimming in water, that our environment itself is a key, that we self-select ourselves to go into a particular type of form of communication. For example, I'm sure we all, you know, had people that we've tried to communicate with, but we just couldn't get them on the phone. Or if more recently, we couldn't get them on email, or we couldn't get them on Facebook, or we couldn't get them on text. And it turns out that they're completely in tune to a different type of medium. So, you know, people don't necessarily want to be on Twitter, or they don't want to be on Facebook. They'd rather use the phone, or they'd rather you be face to face. And each of these different media are profoundly impactful for the way that communication actually gets done. So, for instance, what we're doing here, we're having this conversation and we're talking back and forth. We call that synchronous communication. And you look at Facebook and you look at Twitter and other social media types, and those are asynchronous. Now, they can be very fast, but they're still asynchronous, which means you can send off a message and you may not get a response right away. And you may not get a response in an hour. You may get a response tomorrow or every once in a while, you know, days or even weeks later. That kind of communication element of time is indigenous to a particular media type. And people gravitate towards that. People gravitate towards a specific type of media before they actually do the work itself. So we have this idea of community building and group formation that is generated around a specific type of technology. And we do this at a really large level, like at open source, for example. Open source is a community building endeavor focused around a particular type of technology ideology. The type of technology is not exactly important as opposed to the ideology, but that surrounds the technology and is a communication form, not a technology form.
And there's two things that really fascinate me with that. And I'm drawn towards a couple. The asynchronous is one of the things that I really have embraced a lot. I have this idea for a t-shirt that just basically says embrace asynchronous communication, because people will try and call me like constantly and I'm very asynchronous in many ways. And so I like those, like give me a text message or send me a DM on Twitter. But I find that then augments the way that I communicate with somebody. I would communicate with somebody very, very differently if I had a one-on-one synchronous communication with the way we're talking right now, the way that we introduce, like when I first, you know, get on, I introduce you, I talk to you. There's a couple of things that are embedded in our culture that manifest themselves in synchronous communication. Do you think there's, I don't want to say damage, but do you think, what are the significant ways in which the way we're communicating actually is affected by the medium, by the platform?
Well, there's two answers to that question. There's the what we bring to it as people, and then there's what the technology brings to us as a limiter of communication. So let's talk about the first one first. What we bring to the medium itself is going to be generationally different. So those people who grew up in an environment where the type of synchronous and asynchronous communication was available have a different way of communicating with people, which means that they can context switch very easily to face-to-face or other kinds of phone kinds of conversation, video calls, those kinds of things, because that kind of circuit switching that we have in our communication pattern really lends itself to being able to have that kind of communication. We see a discrepancy between younger tech people and older tech people who are far more used to being able to say, look, if I go into a meeting, I can actually participate and pay attention for longer because I'm used to doing that. The forms of communication that I grew up with and that I learned make me really focus. I mean, unless you've got ADD or something like that, then, you know, generally speaking, it's a generational kind of a situation. More younger people who never grew up without email, never grew up without text messaging, those groups are far more familiar with packet switching as opposed to the circuit switching, which means they try to handle multiple forms of communication at a time. And so it's
that analogy of packet switching versus the circuit switching.
Circuit switching.
Yeah, because it embodies that mindset of how they see that interaction, that interface plane, and they've got a much different interface than for communication expectations.
Yeah, I once had a conversation with Neil Postman about this, and he accused me of being the poster child for new technology.
that's such a bad thing.
Well, I don't, having Neil Postman call you anything was usually a good thing back in that day. So the other part of that question was, how does the technology actually affect us? Well, like that fish and water analogy, the thing is that we speak limited by the software that each form of technology provides us. So for instance, we can do things on Facebook differently than what we could do with MySpace. We can do things on MySpace differently than we could do with Friendster. The success or failure of those companies was in part of what kind of communication capabilities we were able to have. Facebook won out, not because of the fact that it was a better platform, or because it was more secure, or because it was necessarily cooler, but because of the fact that people had a much better way of communicating intuitively on Facebook that was in tune with the way that they wanted to communicate with other people. We do the same thing with our text messages, right? The things that we do with our Apple phones versus our Android phones, the software that actually allows us to do communication profoundly affects the nature of the relationship that we have. For example, emojis. The fights over emojis are indicative of how important it is for the software capabilities to allow us to communicate the way that we want. So think about Twitter as an example. You have 140 characters with some minor exceptions to basically convey your thoughts. The communication patterns and style that we have for Twitter is radically different than the profoundly long Facebook statuses that exist. Or blog posts, right? Those are asynchronous forms of communication too. But the ability to do this in the medium at hand will affect the way that we do the kinds of things that we want to communicate with other people. Some people learn better through YouTube videos. Some people learn better through blogs. Some people learn about things better through Twitter, because Twitter is not a very good educational medium. It's a very good pointer medium. So we don't use it as an educational medium. We don't use it as a debate medium, although we try and fail miserably.
I've seen some great examples of some attempts to really engage in larger debates, and the threading is very tough to follow.
Right. So the overall point here is that we really have, I mean, Marshall McLuhan used to call this hot and cold media, right? That we behave differently according to the types of media that we engage with. You know, television was a cold medium, radio was a hot medium. It has to do with how much participation that we have. Well, the computer and the internet is something of a mixed breed. It's a lukewarm medium. Because we can change the nature of the software, the medium itself changes, and therefore our communication patterns change. So we bring to the table a mix, and then the media brings something to our communication, and that all gets put together into a blender. And when we start talking about developing technology and developing software, we don't even know that we have intuitively internalized these different forms of communication and act accordingly. When we actually come up against each other, we butt heads and we mix. A lot of the times, it's because of the fact that we are trying to mismatch the way that we interact by the form, meaning the actual software that we're using, like trying to debate on Twitter, versus the actual content, which is what we actually wish to communicate from one side or the other. And people will tend to gravitate towards one versus the other. Or if they're highly adept at switching between them at a time, you will find them to be able to multitask. But the problem is that not everybody is in tune with each and every form of media that they use as a communication structure. So for example, if somebody were to try to communicate via a Tumblr approach, and I'm using this as a medium form, not a content form, right? If I, you know, Tumblr is very different than, you know, Twitter. It's very different than Facebook. It's a completely different animal on its own. And there's a different type of person that goes to Tumblr. And they have a way of communicating because the culture that is surrounded by the media form helps guide the type of communication conversations you're going to have. You will have very different types of communication because the culture of people who emerge out of that environment are very different because of the nature of what you're allowed to do because of the software. And that's what I mean when I say that the communication forms we're using are stuff we don't even know when we're talking about it.
Let's do a little crystal ball gazing then. The one thing that really gets me excited is when you're talking about culture and how that culture changes around a particular medium or platform or way of communication. And mm-hmm. So if you will do a little bit of that crystal ball gazing and saying, okay, now we have these different means of communication. You have basically a menu or sort of all sorts of different platforms you could express yourself in different ways and be in different modes and sort of even be different people within some of these communication platforms. Do you see this as sort of exercising our mind even more, like having a much broader idea of what communication is, to one of your points of we have something inside of ourselves that we want to communicate, we have different ways to communicate it. Do you see the broadening of these platforms really creating, you know, exercising all these different muscles, or do you feel like people really just gravitate towards one of them and that then ends up limiting us into just these one small niche cultures and we don't most people don't end up branching out into multiple ones?
Well, you're asking a PhD question.
Well, it's a good thing you have a PhD.
And it's a fair question. My gut instinct at a broad level is that no, what's going to happen is that the humans change far slower than the technology does. And we will force fit our communication contributions into preferences for synchronous versus asynchronous in some sort of mix. The style and the form for those two different types of communication may evolve, but we will eventually just simply move through and adapt as technology forms come and go. I don't think it's going to change. What I do think is that our concept of time will be a big obstacle to overcome when you have different people who choose different forms of communication. And that is going to be the cross-cultural communication that we really need to focus on.
Well, Jay, I think we'll leave it there. Phenomenal conversation today. I really appreciate you chatting with us on the show. Thanks for joining.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Next, I sit down with my co-host and TechWise internet TV sensation, Lauren Malhoit, at Malhoit on the Twitters, about a very unique form of communication that's transforming the way in which applications talk to each other. And by that, of course, I'm talking about APIs. Lauren, it's great to be sitting down with you. How are you doing? What are you up to?
I'm doing well, Eudine. I'm happy to be sitting at home and just kind of taking it easy today. So
I'm not sure if I've ever talked to you at home. Usually,
maybe
like
not.
You're in like, you know, Hong Kong or London or New York. You're at home now. Wow.
It's not always that glamorous, but I won't name any cities in case we have listeners
not
there.
Sure. Internet TV sensation, Lauren. I must be glamorous.
Too kind. I don't know that I'm a sensation. Not yet, anyway. We're working on it.
Perception is reality. Okay, Lauren, just let me sprinkle a little fairy dust on this, okay?
I appreciate that.
So as the theme of our show goes, communication is what we're talking about. And I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about how applications talking to each other or the way in which applications consume services wasn't explored on a show like this. A great article came out in CIO. Big thanks to Ross Mason for putting this out. And this is a series winning in the API economy. And it's entitled What You Can Learn from Amazon. And what was cool about this is that it talks about how in 2002, Bezos realized, as the article says, that innovation at the edges never really works if an organization's core systems are locked up. So in 2002, Bezos realized this and transformed the core of Amazon by making sure every team communicated through APIs, which he described as externalizable services. And
that's a word.
I know, externalizable. Yeah. That's one of those made-up Silicon Valley words, like, let's ideate this.
Right.
Let's make sure this is externizable or externalizable.
Mm-hmm.
Either one works. So in your experience, Lauren, how do you feel like APIs are really transforming not just the way like, you know, applications are communicating with each other, but the way that's changing how teams are working together, how companies are working together, or how companies are even built today? But I mean, it is really a revolutionary form of sort of programmable communication between applications or platforms.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. And, you know, I've just really started kind of scratching the surface of this from a kind of teams communicating situation. Of course, you know, API has been around forever, but, you know, how we're actually using, I guess my question is, what does he mean by teams communicating with each other through APIs? I mean, I get, you know, machine learning and machines talking to each other and disparate things talking so that things work more efficiently and there's less human error. But what do we really mean by teams communicating with each other?
It's like consumable services. Like, I mean, I want to consume sort of the brain of my other team person. So if they're working on a project, I think they need an API. And wouldn't that be great if everyone just had their own personal APIs? I think Brian Gracely might have been talking about this with someone about, you know, everyone having their own set of APIs. And we're kind of scratching our head too. It's like, what would that look like if I had my own API? So basically it would be like, I don't know, access to all my ideas and everything that I was working on. And you could just sort of query it, you know.
Like an API to your brain.
Yeah, exactly. An API to my brain. So I imagine that it would really actually be helpful if you had a set of APIs between different teams so that when you needed something from that other system, like you always were able to query that. Mm-hmm. And you were able to kind of, you know, and imagine this. I imagine a team in Amazon is about the size of, like, you know, a mid-sized company outside of Amazon. So having a mid-sized company having their own set of APIs doesn't seem strange. So actually, I don't think if you make that leap, I don't think it would be that strange for a team within Amazon to have their own APIs that then would make sure that all these different sort of pieces of the Amazon technology puzzle would be able to work to each other and be able to communicate with each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess I hadn't thought of it in that way. So they're literally creating APIs for people to access and putting all of their, you know, hopes and dreams, not really, but their ideas and their their IP, I guess, even, you know, not to put it as intellectual property. Maybe that's the wrong word, but I mean, basically that's what it is, and allowing other teams to access it via, you know, a GET method. Is that?
Make everything restful.
Uh-huh.
It'd be great if just
would they be restful?
The rest of this, can we do the rest of this podcast via RESTful APIs, Lauren? Can you just do a GET request and I can do a PUT request and then we can just go back and forth that way?
Right. Well, and that gets scary, right? Posting to my APIs, right? Yeah. Like, what are you putting in there?
Like? Wait, what did you just post there?
Yeah. It's a family show. I mean, what's the difference between that and really a KB, though?
I think that's an interesting question that you pose. And the article in the CIO doesn't really go into depth, but I think that was just an interesting idea that, you know, teams are communicating via APIs. Because as we know, a lot of the APIs that are set by Amazon, AWS, really become like standard. I mean, like S3 or object storage APIs become like standard just because so many people are using them. And I think that's what they're looking at. And they're talking about communicating from the edge to the core. And if having a set of APIs allows edge projects to communicate in real time so that they're constantly, but do you think that would happen anyways? I think maybe to the core of your point is that if you're working on different projects, because Amazon or AWS has so many different services now, mm-hmm. that their APIs connecting all of these services together. I mean, wouldn't you by default have an API for your project to connect in, you know, to the main AWS platform? Wouldn't that be something that would just be standard because you have to, because that's what you're building it for, so you'd have to have that API connection? I mean, why is this special? Why is it
right.
special that a team has an API to communicate with, you know, on the edge to the core?
And you would think that, yeah, it'd have to be standardized across, I mean, if it's not REST, it'd at least have to be standardized across Amazon, right?
And creating those standards, I think, is one of the things that AWS is really pioneering in, creating standards and APIs where they didn't exist in certain, you know, certain circumstances before. But I think kind of going back to the core idea of, you know, of communication in general and the way APIs are really revolutionizing that way in which you have an application communicating with another application, mm-hmm. you think APIs are going to be the way in which everything is consumed, you think, in the future? I mean, it's already kind of heading in that direction.
Yeah, I immediately think of chat ops, right? Like, it's the demo that every programmability, whatever, you know, shows, because it's a cool demo. I'm chatting with my router or whatever, checking on, you know, status or changing some sort of configuration. And I haven't really loved those demos in the past just because I think it's kind of ridiculous, you know, or I thought, let me put that in past tense. But now I'm actually seeing some ways in which this really could be useful. For example, chatting, you're with the entire team and your equipment, let's say, is in there. And, I'm in the equipment, I'm in the networking world, so I think of that. Of course, there are other use cases. But, you know, if the entire team can see, was just IM'd that the router configuration changed and it shouldn't have. You know, that's an immediate way to get information. Or if I can chat to whatever to get a network diagram so that the entire team can have that and see that real time. That's an interesting use case to me, and becoming even more interesting as people are separated geographically, are separated in time zones, you know, all sorts of things that could be real world use cases. And, you know, maybe that's not the best example off the top of my head, but I think certainly there are becoming some great use cases there.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most salient point. If you can actually include a piece of equipment like a router or something else in a real time, you know, Slack type chat mm-hmm. conversation, then that is really actually a sort of profound improvement in productivity and the ability for you to be able to get to the end result, which is either creating something new or troubleshooting something that exists in a way that you just couldn't before. APIs really opens up that real-time sort of multi-point communication stream that includes now machines, includes application interfaces.
We're finally becoming friends with our machines. We're not allowed to unfriend them, though, probably.
Yeah, they'll find us.
Yeah.
They know exactly where we are. All right. Well, Lauren, thanks. Always a pleasure chatting with you. It's great to see you're at home, maybe kicking your feet up, depending on what time zone you're in. Maybe you have a beer in your hand at this point.
I have a few more hours.
Okay.
But all right. Soon.
All right. Here's to happy hour.
Thanks, Yadin.
Next, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Marshall Kirkpatrick at Marshall K on Twitter, co-founder of Little Bird, a social media influencer platform that was recently acquired by Sprinklr, to talk about what it means to have relevant communication with external stakeholders. Marshall, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So now, Marshall, a lot of companies in Silicon Valley and all around, actually, it's not just in Silicon Valley anymore, tech companies exploding everywhere. They're trying to amplify their message, make themselves bigger than what they are, but also a lot of them have a real good story to tell. They've got good technology or a good solution or a good service, but they're finding it difficult to really reach the people that they want to either convince or tell their story to. And that communication, I think, maybe is a result of them approaching it from a, I wouldn't say impersonal style, but I don't think they're really engaging people, as you have mentioned in conversations I've had with you, in a relevant way. Could you kind of give me a sense what's sort of the dysfunction there, and maybe how can companies be more relevant when they're trying to communicate?
Yes, that's all real well articulated. I think that another way to understand it is that the world has shifted from a broadcast mode into a networked mode, but not all companies have made that shift. So we work with a lot of very large companies that struggle with this as well. But some are doing a great job of understanding that they're a part of a network of conversations and now have to compete with athletes and family members and a contentious president and all kinds of different things that their audiences could be paying attention to, all on a pretty level playing field. And so the secret at the highest level of the most successful companies, I believe, in communicating in a way that's really optimized for relevance is to pay attention to what other people are saying. It's pretty hard to know if your content is relevant to the state of the conversation if you're not listening to that conversation.
And it is really good historical perspective from a communication standpoint, where companies used to have basically an aggregate of, you know, two or three different, you know, mediums. Like you had broadcast television, you had radio, you had print. And if you weren't some big company pumping a bunch of dollars into, you know, broadcasting a message, then, you know, there was really hard to break in too. Now it's not as difficult to get attention, though you could, if you're still in that broadcast mode, be irrelevant to those who are trying to, you know, listen or could possibly listen because you're not listening yourselves. And I think that's, like you pointed out, it seems like it's much more of a two-way street now. What do you feel like the uptake is for companies understanding that paradigm shift and that one-way to two-way street?
It's a challenge, but to explain it perhaps in familiar terms, you might say that the barrier to entry into the global communications marketplace has dropped massively meaning that that millions of new voices have flooded in and really changed the nature of the conversation and changed the power dynamics between the players in that conversation. Just as people have said that the power dynamics between customers and brands has changed in terms of customer experience and user experience, so too in communication, the power dynamics between brands and the group formerly known as the audience or their customers has changed as well. So there's some new rules, some new tactics and strategies that are most effective. But the biggest opportunity, the biggest indicator that you're on the right path towards success is really an experiential path of jumping in and mixing it up and connecting with people who are already successful in social media and in this new conversation. And once you start making connections and those connections start delivering business opportunities and new insights earlier than your peers might have access to those insights, those of us who have had that kind of experience time and time again have just a visceral understanding of the business opportunity that is presented by effective listening instead of just broadcasting.
What I think it's lost, you actually brought this up, I think, I got this from your Twitter feed, actually, which was a fantastic video from Truly Social with Tara talking about how, you know, we posted something, but why didn't everybody notice? And I think one thing that people might hear too from your comment is they're looking for an experience. It's all about the user experience and it's something experiential. And I think I've seen personally how that has been interpreted as, well, we need to create a customer experience like on our website, or we need to create a customer experience like an event or something. It's like, no, you actually need to first care about who you're talking to, actually go and have a real conversation with them, build trust, and that trust then yields value. So deliver or provide value, be authentic, and then do that before you're actually trying to extract value. Is that your perspective?
I would agree with that, yes. Another way that you might put it is that instead of trying to create an experience for your customer, there's a huge opportunity for optimizing what it's like to experience being your customer. And if you can improve what that everyday experience is like, whether that's in the product experience or the communication and marketing experience of being a part of your audience, then that has compounding benefits and will lead to people helping spread the word. That particular video that you referenced is a great example where the content creator Tara Hunt had credibility because she'd been doing this for a long time. And the topic that she recorded that particular video on was super relevant to my experience and so many other people's experiences. You know, I was able to watch that and say, that's something I've been experiencing a lot lately and thinking about a ton. And then she added value by articulating the experience in a way that was more clear than I have been able to in the past, and offering some examples of different tools and tactics that could help me move beyond some of my challenges. Now that's, she just happened to have recorded that video on the challenge of brands feeling like every time they post something, everyone should get excited about it. But she's recorded probably 50 different videos in this series that she's got, many of which have that same kind of relatability and value add through clear articulation and then useful tools for application on my own work challenges that get me so excited that I want to pass them on to other people and help her grow her audience. And by sharing that value out with my audience of people says, wow, Marshall sure does find great, useful videos consistently. I'm going to spread the word about Marshall's work, and I'm going to pass along this video from Tara that says, you know, shared via Marshall Kirkpatrick as well. And we all get to create this sense of abundance by contributing relevant, clear, valuable content on a consistent basis over time.
I think that's an excellent point, because
I think a lot of people are realizing now or feel more intuitively now that individuals are far more relatable than a brand is. Say a logo, if you're tweeting with a logo or you're looking to subscribe to a logo, you're not feeling that same level of connection and trust. And it's tough to build an audience as a logo, but if you build an audience as a collection of individuals.
Well, I want to challenge that, actually. I think that a brand and a logo can build a great audience and a great connection to their audience if they're paying attention and they're willing to meet the audience halfway. If you are able to create content where the audience says, you know, I can relate to that experience or to that idea. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. It's super relevant to me. A logo can do that just as effectively as an individual, or almost as effectively. But one of the big challenges is being nimble enough to know where people are at in order to meet them there, to not have such tight brand constraints that you've got to constantly stay on 100% your own message. So it's harder from an operational corporate strategy perspective, but the potential upside is huge.
I've experienced that where there's been organizations that, but they're usually small. But it's interesting that you feel like a brand can really do that effectively. But I see the danger there where if you're not paying attention to what the customer, what your audience really needs and what actually would help them in their own lives, both personally
yes.
or professionally.
I'll give you two examples, one big one, one little one. Microsoft uses our software, for example, to tap into the trends and the topics and the language and the concerns that certain thought leaders in their target markets are discussing online. And then they're able to address those concerns from a Microsoft perspective. And to speak like a living, breathing member of their customers' communities is the way they put it. And on a small level, I personally notice that, you know, I tweet all day long a lot. And a lot of times I'm just spouting off my opinions about various things that I have in front of me, that I have on my mind. And those things sometimes are well received. But when I go over to, for example, TechMeme, the best tech news aggregator on the web for the past decade or so, and I see what all the top tech blogs are talking about over the last 5 minutes, and if there's an opportunity for me to add value to one of those conversations, then all of a sudden my commentary has far more relevance to a larger audience of people, and it's much better received and gets passed along a lot.
One final thought, I think, to kind of wrap this up, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with Clayton Christensen's jobs theory, but it just talking to you just kind of strikes me as one of a critical component of this process really falls along the lines of jobs theory, which basically states that you're really looking to find, if you're going to go ahead and either engage with someone, create a product or service, or in this case, communicate with them, understanding what they are outside of a persona or outside of a customer specification or a target market, really actually doing a mini documentary understanding of someone that you only get through having a conversation with them. And then once you've done that, engage them in a way that actually is going to help them make progress in what they're trying to do, understanding the social, emotional, and political components of the environment in which they're operating in. It sounds like what your perspective is actually taking that relevant engagement approach and finding out what that sort of their job to be done is by engaging with them, let's say like in a tech meme or at events or really one-on-one, and you don't have to do a million of these. But just a few of them to start understanding what that type of person or that type of group is really trying to accomplish.
Yep, for sure. Get to know specific people that you think are probably representative of larger concerns and create abundance together. And you'll move towards the center of the network where all the value is flowing, and you'll be able to capture value as you contribute it.
Let me have you look in your crystal ball really quick, Marshall. Where do you see the understanding of these sort of large or mid-size or even small tech companies for that matter, their perspective changing from that broadcast to network sort of communication style? And how are you seeing that shift happening? Let's say just use Silicon Valley or the tech industry at large as an example of how that mode is shifting.
Well, Ray Wong at Constellation always highlights just how much turnover there's been on the Fortune 500 decade by decade. So it's hard for legacy brands to change, and only some presumably will effectively. And hopefully legacy business models will be able to change at the hands of technology and priorities, so that the planet we live on will remain habitable long term, so that we can change these ideas.
Let's hope that happens.
Yeah. The author of The Empathic Civilization says there's a race between the communication technology that's bringing us together, Jeremy Rifkin, a race between the communication technology bringing us together and the carbon intensive civilization that enables that communication technology and its devastating consequences. So let's communicate while we can as effectively as possible
to hopefully save the world.
Uh-huh. Yep. Nothing less is needed.
Well, Marshall, thanks for coming up on the show and providing some really unique perspective.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Next, I sit down with Kat Troyer at DailyCat on Twitter, co-CEO of Tech Reckoning and the IMC, about the importance of leadership and culture with tech companies with regards to the success or failure of communication platforms like Slack, Yammer, Chatter, and others. Kat, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad you can come on. So you've had a lot of experience with the success and failure of different types of communication channels. And these can be like, you know, organic, it'd be face-to-face, asynchronous, mm-hmm. synchronous. I wanted to get your perspective on what does it take within an organization from a leadership and culture perspective for a communication channel to really be successful. And a lot of the times, and I've been a huge supporter of the view that it's not the tool that comes first, it's really the process or the issue or the need that comes first, and there's a tool to support it. What's the keys for even apply a tool to it?
Yeah, I think it all goes back to company culture, Yadin, and how open the culture is. That depends on leadership and values and alignment with those values. So I think that it's taking a step back and looking at all those things and making sure that everything's lined up. And then, of course, there's a communication strategy when you roll out a tool, right?
Well, let's dig into that communication strategy, because I think some people put the cart before the horse, because I've been in so many situations in which, let's say, a company says, well, let's use Slack. I don't want to pick on Slack because I love Slack. It's fantastic. But people say, let's use Slack. Slack is great. I've heard a lot of great things about it. It's going to make everyone more productive. It's going to be wonderful. But what's the danger there of saying, let's go for a tool and implement a tool to then solve a problem? Is that putting the cart before the horse?
I've seen Slack, companies that use Slack really effectively, and then I've seen Slack where it might seem kind of underused compared to other companies, right? So that goes back to, I think, leadership, and also, I mean, really encouraging people to speak their truth, right? Because if people don't feel safe in being able to speak their opinions, that goes back to culture.
Well, that's really interesting. And I guess maybe what is that role of leadership in supporting those types of environments and giving people a place where they feel like they can kind of express themselves over these platforms, let's say like Yammer, for example, or Slack, for example, where they feel comfortable in expressing themselves in the way they need to get what they need done and develop those relationships within the company?
Yeah, I think, again, it starts with engagement at all levels, right? So leaders can go in and, they can go in and use the tool the way that they think it should be used, and then people will follow that lead. You know, you've always got the element where there are people who tend to be a little bit more dominant, and then there are the folks that, you know, have valid opinions but still hold back. So that's where leadership rolls in. And also help to moderate a little bit when opinions may come in that might be outside of, you know, some of the values or some of the culture. I think facilitation is super important there.
And let me tug on that thread of moderation too, because I know there's been a lot in the news about Facebook monitoring, Google monitoring, and YouTube. I know this isn't exactly along the lines of corporate communication, but I think there's been a big emphasis lately on how much moderation and how much sort of oversight you need within these communication platforms, especially within an organization. It's the employees that are actually generating sort of this discourse. Where do you think that role of moderation and oversight plays a role, especially from a leadership perspective, and how that affects the way that people feel like they can express themselves?
It's an art, right? You've got to be sensitive.
And yeah, there's no silver bullet for that, is there?
Exactly. But I think that, you know, going back to when you roll out the tool, talking about usage and what would be the ideal usage.
I think you hit on a couple of really key topics. One of them is that people don't really realize when they're on a forum like this, even though their real identity is part of the platform, there's this sense of anonymity and empowerment, aka sort of the troll effect. Within an organization, it's extremely difficult when you have people who are seeing this platform as something to joke around about or something to, you know, to use as, you know, as a, you know, as a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing, in addition to creating work, also, you know, making off-the-cuff comments. And there's some real implications for if you're using Yammer, Slack, you're using Chatter, this stuff is kept forever. If you're doing things like you're digitally bullying people or creating an uncomfortable work environment or even sexually harassing somebody, are you ever seeing any of those situations in which the platform emboldens people in a way that a face-to-face, you know, interaction wouldn't?
I see that all the time. I mean, I think that, I mean, you see it out there outside of company forums, right? But it happens inside too. And those are the kind of things that I'm talking about where, you know, those are the red flags that I'm talking about. Those are things that you have to address.
Maybe just as a final note, from your perspective, you think is there anything inherently dangerous in the platform itself that lends itself to lose things like you mentioned, context?
Mm-hmm.
There's meaning and inference that is very, you know, verbally tonal and relies on context of the conversation that gets lost. Do you think there's anything inherently dangerous that needs extra special attention when you're getting people on these platforms and having them use them correctly?
You know, I think the benefits completely outweigh the challenges or the risks. And I think the important thing is an awareness that there is risks and that there can be risks and that you want to address them sooner rather than later. And a lot of times the best way to handle this is to pick up the phone and have a conversation. If tone isn't being picked up in writing.
Kat, this was great. I think some good insights here and also some good direction for those looking to roll out some of these types of platforms and engage in positive communication. I appreciate you joining.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Research for this podcast was powered by Sprinklr, the social media management platform. To find out more about them, you can go to sprinklrwithnoe.com. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice and leave us a review if you will. It helps others find us. Also, we love hearing from you, the listeners, your story ideas, your thoughts on the tech world, and what you're doing as well, so that we can make this show as relevant to your daily tech life as possible. So hit us up on Twitter using #InTechWeTrust. We'll be checking that daily to start conversations, engage with people, and get your thoughts. You can also follow us at @InTech_WeTrust and give us your thoughts there as well. See you next time. Oh.